Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a hearty slice of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this, our first show of 2018, we shuffle through the makeup, frocks and scripts of the panto world as we look deeper into a modern classic. We prepare ourselves for a host of learning and wonder as LGBT Month approaches, and we dig out some themed classics and new cuts of music to keep the speakers shifting. If you're new to the show, you can catch up on all of our shows to date at www.kingofthebuttons.co.uk, or you can link through our blog, thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. If you have an idea for a future show or simply want to get in touch, you can also email us through the blog. We start with a reflective look at December's celebration of queer arts and culture, the Shout Festival, and we take a glance at upcoming activity for LGBT History Month in February. I caught up with creative guide and organiser Adam Carver for a better insight. Okay, so I'm here with Adam Carver. Adam, you're the, I'm going to try and get this right, you're the producer and curator for the Shout Festival of Queer Arts and Culture.
That's correct, yeah.
That's a hell of a title, isn't it?
I know, right, it's really wordy, so we thought really well about that when we chose it.
And excitingly, Shout, I think, happened across November, sort of beginning of January. So should we start with that?
Because
folks might not know what that is.
Well, Shout, for anyone who doesn't know, is a 10-day festival of what they call combined arts. So that's a mix of film and performance and visual arts, events, talks, workshops, anything that comes into that broad arts and culture label that looks specifically at the perspectives and identities and experiences of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and queer people. So that's kind of our remit. And it's an annual festival that happens every year. It's been running in the city for 8 years. No, this is its ninth year coming. So 2018 is the ninth year.
And there's and behind it is an organisation that's been in the city, I think, about the same kind of time?
Or? Yeah, so it's actually a project of the Birmingham LGBT Centre, which is a holistic health and wellbeing service for LGBT people in the city that covers all kinds of services, from looking for out for people older over 50, sexual health services and domestic violence services. There's a fitness service, there's support services, all kinds of different things that happen there. So we're one of the many projects that run at that centre.
So the festival really, I guess, tries to take on quite a complex mix of things. And what I mean by that is, I suppose, people might come to it and say, what are we shouting about?
Yeah, I think for me the most important thing that we do is it's about, well, there's two things. One is about advocacy. It's about representation, really. It's about making sure that people who are LGBTQ are represented in our arts venues across the city, and that those stories and narratives are platformed in the same way that stories of non-LGBT people are. It's about sort of addressing an imbalance. So politically, for us, it's kind of motivated around making sure that those stories are often quite invisible and making them more visible, like shouting about them in a kind of way about proclaiming that they are here, and also about bridging gaps as well between LGBT communities and non-LGBT communities in terms of like finding empathy and mutual understanding and like learning. I think that's a really important part of what we do as well.
So there's something about sort of capturing, I guess, the diversity of views, and there's something about, I guess, meaning, giving meaning to those views and giving voice to them. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's about finding places that we can provide opportunities for people to have, you know, their own voices heard, and across a really broad range. You know, it's a very big umbrella term, and there's lots of different perspectives and sort of identities and understandings within that framework as well. So it's not just about maybe one kind of presentation of what people might think it is to be that. We're about challenging those expectations and presenting a sort of multiple perspectives on what it is to be within that community, to be LGBTQ. So I think that, yeah, it is about that, and it's about making sure that people feel represented and heard. And I think it's something really powerful about being able to see yourself and hear stories about that, about your own kind of experiences, because otherwise, as I said before, they can become invisible, and actually that's a really difficult kind of place to sort of negotiate from.
Now, the challenge for anyone who has curator in their title is massive, I think, because you've always got to sort of keep people happy but keep them interested. And I think Shout this year, you had a real mix of different things. So one of the things that really caught my eye was the Ian Sanderson sort of photo exhibition.
Yeah.
Which was, I guess, photos of sort of 70s and 80s, I think.
So it was an exhibition of documentary photography that was sort of covering the Gay Liberation Front in the 1970s in Birmingham, which was a national movement, mainly campaigning for in the years after the 1967 Sexual Offences Act, which decriminalised male homosexuality, campaigning for other kinds of legal equality, for representation, and they also provided support networks. They set up Gay Switchboard, which was like a telephone calling service that people would anonymously ring into for support. So they managed all kind of projects like that. And this was sort of a collection of documentary photography that was taken by someone who was living in Birmingham in the 1970s, of them at protests and marches and rallies, and also socially setting up the first gay and lesbian centre in Birmingham, which is also the first publicly funded centre in the UK. So it's all documenting that time, really. And I came across the images. They were sent to me by a mutual friend between the photographer and I. And we just sort of started digging into this huge archive of images that he'd collected as a student when he was studying photography. And he, you know, they'd never been displayed and people had never seen them before. A lot of them hadn't been developed either. So it was kind of one of those things where I felt like it was really important for us to be able to represent those histories and the histories of our city in the places here, and sort of bring out that history that I think people have forgotten and don't necessarily know happened. And some of the images are just really stunning pictures of really political, really charged, and they felt really sort of pertinent for where we were at 2017.
So I guess the exhibition itself, or that particular sort of photo exhibition, something about the legacy of where we are in terms of LGBT, the rights agenda, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was an opportunity for us to kind of look back. Last year, 2017, was the 50th anniversary of partial decriminalisation of homosexuality in England and Wales. And so we got to look back over the last 50 years and work out how things have changed, what progress has been made, and also what journeys there are still to go. And I think that was a really important part of it, you know, to look at where we were, to be able to kind of talk quite openly about those issues and identities in a public space, in family spaces here, and really try and out those perspectives and histories in a way that celebrated them. But also I think it was important to kind of recognise the steps that were still to go in those journeys as well. You know, we haven't completely reached total equality yet. You know, legally that only happened in the last sort of 2 or 3 years. But we're still people, you know, their experiences of homophobia and biphobia and transphobia and discrimination still are very present and very pertinent. And I think that, you know, the title of the exhibition was We Often Find It Necessary to Keep Our Homosexuality Quiet, which was taken from a leaflet that the GLF produced. And it was the opening line of trying to get people to sort of be recruited to the cause, really. And I think that was really pertinent when we were talking about what we were going to do and how we're working, this sense of like not being able to always be out in situations. It felt like it was good to be able to put that idea into a public forum.
I think there's something there, isn't there, about it being, you know, a really timely reminder and a recognition of how difficult and, you know, a struggle to achieve that sort of change in the law. Now we perhaps look back at it and see it as perhaps, you know, a technical thing.
Yeah.
But actually, at the time, it was massive. It was really,
yeah, huge, huge. And I think, you know, this is the photos were in this decade preceding that law. But prior to that point, you know, it was illegal. People were arrested and imprisoned. They were, you know, subsequently sent to you know, it was treated as a psychological condition to be gay. People were sent to all kinds of institutions. They were sort of tried to be cured and treated, electroshock therapy. And I think actually that was and that's still within living memory. I think, you know, part of the reason behind doing the exhibition was that we wanted to kind of find a small way to be able to sort of honour the people who were part of that movement and sort of made those changes and like campaigned for stuff, but made support available and let people know, you know, in an age before the internet was here, finding ways to connect with each other and to meet other people and to stop feeling, you know, so isolated. We're really kind of standing on the shoulders of giants doing that as well. So I thought it was really important for us to be able to kind of provide a space in which we could celebrate their work and achievements as well.
And it's a really useful marker, I think, in terms of, you know, you've touched on it yourself, but the dialogue that's still necessary to achieve that equality and that parity, really. So, you know, you can change a legal status or a legal, you know, sort of position, but actually there's a whole lot more in terms of awareness and understanding and appreciation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, where we are for certain parts of the LGBTQ community is much further ahead than for others. And actually looking at the if you look back to the 70s and those kind of protest movements and moving along with women's lib as well at the time, that's very similar to where, for example, the trans community is now, like where they're campaigning for this kind of representations and for access to healthcare and access to, you know, legal protection and understanding. And I think that, you know, that's kind of, there's a lot of work still to do. There's a lot, you know, issues that affect people on a day-to-day basis that can really cause, like, be very damaging, and I think isolation is a really big problem in that as well. But also, like, more outwardly, we've seen this rise in the last few years of racial tensions and of sort of anti-gay sentiments, homophobic, transphobic sentiments. The rise of hate crime over the last 18 months is marked, and I think this came at a really difficult and important time for us to be kind of considering and reflecting on these histories and where things are going and where they could potentially end up, and you know, we were sort of looking at where's the world moving now. And looking backwards is always a really interesting way to kind of think about moving forwards.
Now, you're not someone that rests on their laurels, because having just finished the Shout Festival, there's a lot of activity, I think, coming up for LGBT Month in February.
So February is LGBT History Month, and we started last year to mark the 50th anniversary of decriminalisation. We did a short mini festival, really, in February, which was the Birmingham LGBT History Festival, and that's back for this year. It's a series of events and mostly film screenings and discussions around that, where we kind of look at the history of representation. So we'll be screening some newer films, some old films, looking at, for example, we've got the rights to the first television programme that featured a transgender character on British television. And we'll be talking around the history of representation of trans people in the media, and then screening that film with a kind of discussion-based form around it. And that's working with venues across the city and with partners from different universities. We're also hosting this year Outing the Past, which is the National LGBT History Festival, and that's going to be happening at Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery as part of their, alongside their exhibition, which is on at the moment coming out, which is Queer Art from 1967 to 2017, and it's got Tracy Emin and Andy Warhol and Grayson Perry and all kinds of big names within that. And we're hosting Outing the Past, which is the national festival. And I've invited a programme of speakers from all over the country to come and talk about different aspects of history, share their experiences, their stories. So people come in to talk about publications, about the history of what it was like to be trans in the 70s. We've got someone coming to talk about the impact of Section 28 and a whole broad range of programmes in that that's happening all as part of this 5 days of activity that we've got planned at the end of February.
That sounds fantastic. So locally, are there people that sort of are supporting, and sort of any celebrities, anyone, any names you can reveal yet, or is it still early days?
Well, this festival is much more about kind of the perspectives of everyday people and about what it's like to sort of live through those experiences. We've certainly worked with a number of big names and stuff before, and certainly I can't reveal anything for this year's main festival yet, because we're still figuring it all out and putting stuff. There's some very exciting names in there, so
keeping us on tenterhooks.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the way to do it. So folks that are interested in coming along to things that the festival's the month's running, where would they find that? Where should they look?
Best place to find us is on our website, which is www.shoutfestival.co.uk. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram at Shout Festival, and we keep all of our stuff going out on there all the time. But there's a full listing to everything we do, and you can find out more about the organisation and all the rest of the work that we're doing through those channels.
I will definitely do that, and I will also make a point to come along to some of those activities because they sound intriguing, and that's very much my bag.
Good. All right.
But well, for now, Adam, thanks very much for your time.
No problem at all. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the New Curiosities Box, and I'm James Sandy. Now, it's not often that you get to go backstage with a dame, certainly not with one of such distinction. Towards the end of their pantomime run at the Belgrade Theatre, Coventry, I sat down with director, actor, writer Ian Laughlin and stage manager Graham Baird to help the glass slipper fit and to explore the many aspects of their innovative production of Cinderella.
Okay, so despite lots of people shouting, oh no, it isn't, it is still panto season, and I'm lucky enough to be somewhere in the back end of Coventry's Belgrade Theatre, and I'm joined by Graham Baird, who's the stage manager, and by Ian Laughlin, the writer and director of Cinderella. Now, Ian,
yes?
Let's start with Cinderella, because
It's
a classic, isn't it?
It is. It's the favourite. Really?
It is.
Yeah, well, for most people anyway, it's their favourite. For the public, certainly, it's an easier sell because, I suppose because Disney picked it up, that helps, and it made it very popular. But it is a lovely romantic, it's one of the romantic pantomimes, because you've got the romantic pantomimes, you've got the adventure pantomimes, and it's most certainly the most favourite, the favourite of all of them, I'd say, because both boys and girls like coming to see it because of the magic and because of and the girls love it. A lot of them come dressed as Cinderella, don't they?
So it's it is a classic. It is a traditional story. Now, that's helpful in a way because people can identify with it and they recognise it. But also imagine it's a bit sort of challenging in terms of having to bring new things in, do things differently.
Yeah, because you want to stick to the story because people expect the story. Mm. They want to see Cinderella and the ugly sister, you know, being challenged by the ugly sisters, and you want to see the stepmom and being horrible to her and all that. So buttons and that relationship that which is completely separate, and then you've got the fact that where you know they tear up her invitations, you can't go to the ball. Fairy godmother arrived. It's all that fairy story that it's all about dreams really. Mm. It's about Cinderella's dream of wanting to get out of the situation that she's in with no love, really. It's about the prince's dream who wants to get out of the palace and meet someone that he's going to love and not just, you know that he can't get to... He doesn't have the freedom either to go out and meet people and that sort of thing. It's all about Button's dream because he's in love with Cinderella. And it's all about the ugly sister's dream. They want to get married to some rich man and have an easy life. And it's about the fairy godmother who makes dreams come true.
Now you're a seasoned panto person, I think.
Uh-huh.
You've got form. You've got form, as they say, and probably in a different trade. But also, so again, I guess there's a challenge each year for you to sort of, if you're doing a similar story or you know, perhaps the same story, to bring something new to it. But the other thing I think probably is worth saying about you is you've got a lot of history, I think, in sort of children's television.
Yes, I have, yeah.
And I recognise you, in fact, from, I think, Play School.
Play School, yeah.
So that ages me, but obviously keeps you forever young.
Absolutely so does, yeah.
So obviously it's a family show, but how difficult is it to mix it, to make it sort of, you know, accessible to the mums and dads as well as the kids?
I mean, we do a very family-based show here. We don't do lots of blue gags or anything like that. And everything's accessible for both. I mean, it's a show you can bring your granny to, really. There's enough for the kids. And there's enough for the... There's little cheeky gags, isn't there?
One or two little innuendos sneak out.
That's right. I mean, little cheeky sort of funny things, which the audience, the adults will get, but the kids won't bother. And that's all part of panto, really. But we never go really for the blue gags. And the important thing, and I think Graham will back me up on this, is the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's telling the story. Mm. That's the important thing. And no matter what story you decide to do, whether it's Jack and the Beanstalk, or whether it's Sinbad, or whether it's Beauty and the Beast, or Cinderella, you have to tell the story. And there are two kinds of characters on stage. There's a story characters, like Cinderella, she's a story character. And then there's the other characters, like the Ugly Sister or Buttons, who break the fourth wall and contact the audience. And of course, the final character in every one of the pantos is the audience. You yes. never have your full cast until you open and you have your audience, because the audience is so important in panto.
It's always a difficult one when rehearsals, isn't it? Because if we're working with somebody who's new to panto, whether they're just new to the business or new to panto, it can be quite a grasp for them just to get their head around it, because it's unlike any other form of theatre. You really don't know what you're going to be getting until you first get an audience, because yeah. no matter how much you tell them, how much you warn them, the look of shock and awe on these little white faces. So, yeah, so the lights go down and the audience just kick off. It's
Graham, I was going to ask you, because the difficulty, I think, with sort of being a stage manager is really you've got to help realise Ian's mad ideas, haven't you? Really, you've got to kind of make them practical.
I just say no.
Spend
all day seeing. It's not so much of a challenge now, because we've worked together for 6 years, so we know each other very well. And we know how each other works, and I can sort of second guess what Ian wants a lot of the time, which takes a lot of the pressure off of him. So I can talk to a lot of technical departments and say, this is what we're looking for, this is what we're trying to achieve, and this is what the end result needs to be. Mm. And Ian can concentrate on other aspects of production, whether it's acting in it or whether it's doing the directing. He doesn't have to worry about that sort of thing. I can just carry on. And 9 times out of 10, I get it right.
Oh, no, absolutely. It's fantastic having... And I think that's the basis of having a successful show, and it's having a successful team around about you, because even though I write it and direct it and I'm in it, I've got Graham who's my DSM, I've got Jenny who's my choreographer, she's done it for a number of years, I've got Paul who's my assistant director, I've got Craig now who's been our comic for six years. And all together, just the team coming together. And I'm a musical director, of course, Miles, who's actually new this year. I've not used Miles before, but he's been absolutely brilliant. Everybody coming together and just working on it and making sure that it is the best it can possibly be. You couldn't do it without the team, you know. And everyone has to kind of understand each other, and everyone sort of knows now, really.
It does sound corny, but it is like a big family now, isn't it?
Yeah.
We all get on so well together when we all understand how each other works. And it's just, we all put things in the pot and hope it comes out.
Let's talk about some of the other aspects of it as well, because I was really interested to see in some of the sort of press release stuff, the things that you're doing around kind of relaxed performances. Yeah. And I guess it might be worth starting initially with trying to explain what that is. I mean, I've got a kind of an idea about that, but that's really sort of trying to open it out and making it perhaps as accessible as it can be.
Relaxed performances are really for those people who would normally be able to come and see a show in the theatre for any number of reasons. Principally, it's people with mental health issues or disabilities. For instance, dementia sufferers, people on the autistic spectrum who a visit to the theatre would be just too much for them to take in, too much to cope. And the whole point about theatre, it should be completely inclusive, or as inclusive as you can possibly make it. And to do that, we have to make sure that we can broaden our spectrum a little bit ourselves. So it's a difficult thing to... plan in the initial stages, because you don't want to come across as condescending to anyone. You also need to keep the integrity of the show, so you can't change it radically, but the way you get around that is to put as much information in advance as possible and to understand the needs that people would have. For instance, we sat down, we had a production meeting a few weeks ago, and we were talking about mental health issues and autism in particular, which is very much misunderstood, I think, and the needs of people that are on the spectrum. Because I mean, everyone's different on this. Everyone has different needs, but you have to kind of generalise, otherwise it's not going to work. So we change little things. We put out information packs. Ian did a Bible on the different characters. I did one on the storybook to take people through everything so that they're not huge surprises. We don't change much in the show itself, because again, that would be cheating. We'll tone the music down a little bit. Some of the noisier effects we'll take out, but as an opening to it, Ian will come on in costume as one of the uglies and just introduce the set and introduce the musicians in the pit, and then we'll talk about the smoke and the pyrotechnics. And all this information's been available to people already, and we've run drop-in sessions where people are free to come into the auditorium and have a chat and look at the set and see the haze machine working and see the caption machine working. So these things are not too much of a shock to the system because you don't want to trigger flashpoints and what have you.
So it's kind of about depth, I guess. You kind of a much broader palette of the production.
Yeah, principally, yeah. But it's the same show. I mean, you don't want to shortchange anyone, do you?
No, that's right. Yeah.
This is the thing. It's still got to hold itself together as a show. Hmm. But it has to be an accessible thing. The Belgrade is very, very keen to promote this sort of thing now, especially with the dementia work programme and through the community education departments, all the great work that they do for people that have special educational needs. And this is the first time we've done this one. So it's a learning process for all of us. And we've worked with different groups like this before in the past, but this is the first time either of us have done a full, relaxed performance. So these things are they're just as rewarding for us, aren't they? Really?
Oh, very much so.
You get a great deal out of it. We
also do Touch Tour for the Blind, which we've done for a number of years, where we invite the blind in on a in before the show, and we do a little performance for them in costume, so they can hear the voices. They can hear the voices of the characters, and they can recognise. And then we go into the auditorium. We meet them. They can feel all the costumes. They chat to the characters, and they get a picture in their heads of what these characters look like. And they hear little musical themes or that belong to the characters and that sort of thing, and just try and build up a picture of the characters and what they sound like before they see the show. Then they come and they, some of them are partially sighted, some of them are blind, and that's hugely successful. And of course we do signing and all that sort of stuff as well, but it's just this, the relaxed performance is the new one, and we're hoping to be able to get it right this year.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing. I think as you mentioned, it does help theatre do perhaps what it should be doing. Accessible and help.
It should be inclusive. It shouldn't be just a niche thing for people.
Now the other thing that you've done, I think, which is dangerous, you do a lot of dabbling in magic and villainy, because that's the nature of the beast, isn't it? But you've also enlisted, I think, the help of the Women's Institute locally of the relaxed performance with something I'm reliably called is a twiddle muff.
Absolutely.
So you're going to help me clarify that, because obviously I might be pulled from the air otherwise. If
we've got in some very dark alleyways here.
Yes, indeed.
The WI have very kindly been knitting their fingers off for us for this. They're basically like little woolen mitt type things, but they have different colours through them and different textures to them and different appendages. It's like a comforter. It's like a comfort for the hands, so that kids have got something that they can hold and they can stroke and they can just pull apart, and which they will. And they're great. It's wonderful little stuff. It's just an extra comforting device to help them feel secure.
So it's also, I think, a curious thing, isn't it? So I asked that question because I was curious about it. And it kind of, builds on that sort of mystery of the beast as well.
And it's seemingly, I mean, I didn't know about them, but it seemingly helps with some of the kids on the autistic spectrum, because they have to do something with their hands. And they'll have their own twiddle toys probably as well. But we thought we'd provide some stuff as well. And also ear defenders if they want them. And that sort of stuff. So we just try to think of everything, so we'll see what happens, we'll see how it goes. I'm sure we'll get with some feedback.
One way or another.
And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Adam Carver, Ian Lachlan, Graham Baird, Belgrave Theatre Coventry and Mac Birmingham for their time and support in the making of this programme. The new Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production 2018 for Switch Radio 107.5 FM, DAB and online.